Welcome to Circuit Breaker episode 18. I have my guest Adam Krosno here today from On Asset. I believe Adam might have a few other companies. We'll find out a little bit later. First off, this is the last episode ever recorded in Nerdvana's podcast booth. Thank you so much for Nerdvana for hosting us for the last, I believe, at least 10 episodes. It's been a fantastic experience here, but sadly to say, they're all going away. I know everybody's heard about it from either Coffee with Kyle's. Shout out to those guys. And shout out to Nerdvana to turn this into a live stream gaming booth for esports that's happening here in Frisco. Another huge shout out to Launchpad City. So, Adam, it's great to have you here. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thanks for having me. So I'm the CEO and founder of On Asset Intelligence. We've been in business for about 12 years now, doing asset tracking in the formerly M2M, now IoT space, but focused on supply chain applications. So think about a high-value package or shipment that you're transiting anywhere from origin to destination, and we make a small device and offer a service that you can track and monitor that anywhere in the globe. So we do a lot of work in pharmaceuticals, high-value electronics, gold, diamond, jewelry, transportation, whatever you want to send somewhere, but you need much more visibility than the typical transport providers can manage.
That's kind of awesome. So how did you guys start with this, with the idea of asset tracking? What was the genesis of this? I mean, you guys have been around for a long time, and you guys kind of are some of the firsts, right? So how did you start with it?
It was a bit of a roundabout path. I started with an industrial automation company doing robotic systems, and we started playing with RFID technology to automatically identify pieces and parts that robots needed to assemble. So that got us into the space of kind of tracking assets and doing something on an automated basis with it. But it was really that RFID experience that got us involved in a couple trade shows. And ultimately, DHL, the world's largest logistics company, reached out to us and said, "This RFID technology looks interesting. Can we apply it to the world of logistics?" So we built an RFID-enabled delivery vehicle for them back in 2006. Took it around on the trade show circuit. It was pretty neat. Connected it to a back-end software platform, so you'd get real-time information on packages loaded and offloaded from the vehicle when they were delivered, all through a mapping interface that was highly graphical and pretty intuitive. Everybody liked it, and then ultimately DHL determined they couldn't spend the money to put an RFID tag on every box that they would ship, but they loved the visibility it gave them, so they said, "Can you make a device that can ride with an individual shipment to give us that same level of real-time visibility, but something we can focus on the real high-value shipments we move?" And that's what really led us to what we're doing today. So we have, a product called the Sentry 500 device that's about the footprint of a business card. You place inside of a package, and it tracks it. It records all the sensor information from temperature, shock, handling, light, everything you'd need to know about something that's being handled or moving through the global supply chain. And you can dial into a web interface and set up alerts and basically have your package tell you if it's on track, on time, and being handled appropriately.
That's fantastic. And then that led to the world's first FAA tracker, or FAA compliant tracker, I believe, or you have something going on with the ability to go up in the air and still be able to be compliant for tracking. So you don't have to physically manage, right?
Absolutely. So it just so happens that most of the high value cargo or shipments that move tend to get on an aircraft because they usually have to move quickly. They have to be moved securely. So the things people would pay to track in real time gravitate toward the air cargo space. So that required us to have a device that could automatically suppress its transmitting radios because the FAA has particular regulations relative to autonomous devices in the cargo hold. So we developed and patented a technology called FlightSafe that allows the device effectively to detect when it's loaded on an aircraft so it can shut down all the radios and transmitters but still record all of the handling and sensor data throughout flight. And we ultimately tendered that technology to the FAA, several major global airlines, And we became the first device in the world to be formally approved by an aviation regulator, which opened the door to the airlines to formally approve us. And as of today, we have almost 90 global airline approvals, which are the majority of the major cargo movers in the world. We have FAA and EASA, which is Europeans' equivalent of FAA, native approval of the device. So we started to carve a path, and that's really what we're known for in the space. And I'll tell you, being able to deal with the aviation landscape, that is the strictest regulatory landscape you can imagine. So everything else is easier.
That's amazing. And so now, I mean, this is a startup dream story, right? So you were literally starting this out of your garage and then literally have blown up into this amazing story that even major telecoms and logistics companies and airlines and everything else now count and rely on you to help provide them the new technology they need to do. One of the things, I mean, that's how you and I met, is through the telecom industry, and you guys have been playing with a lot of the new radios. So where are you seeing the asset tracking space moving to next? Are you taking advantage of any of the new capabilities with the new chipsets, especially the low power ones? What do you think about those?
You know, I think it's great technology and things are definitely moving there. It's still a little bit of a fragmented landscape in the sense that, you know, our devices travel anywhere in the world. It can literally be in 5 or 6 different countries by the time you have a full delivery that occurs. So we have to have something that is global, works the same everywhere in the world. And some of the new LTE technologies, you know, Cat-M, LTE, NB, all that stuff is great. And I think it's definitely the future. The problem is you can't use it globally yet. It'll get there soon, I do believe. But we have to have a technology that is consistent everywhere in the world just due to the nature of the business we operate. And that's, you know, we love to see the bright, shiny technology, but we've got to throttle ourselves because we can't embed it and deploy it and certify it in a globally used product like this until it's that consistent. So we've got a big eye on it. We've played with it. We've kicked the tires. We're excited about it. You know, but it's still going to be a couple years before the time is right and you can do it on a global basis.
You know, this is one of those things I've had this conversation over and over and over again on the various episodes. And people have said, you know, we're not ready for it in this certain areas, and in certain areas, the industry is perfect for it. Like you said, in the asset tracking and thing moving space, especially when it crosses borders, especially when it crosses from telecom to telecom, it's completely useless, right? And this is one of the first times in a long time where I've seen the telecoms push a new radio, but the chipset manufacturers are not ready for it, versus the other way around. Usually it's the chipset manufacturers who are trying to push this new technology, right? So when LTE came out, the rollout was very quick because the chipset manufacturers were ready for it in this case. And the telecoms were not quite ready for it, but they were able to push it out a little bit faster because of the market demand. In this case, we've been talking about Cat 0, Cat M for going on 3 years now, and the deployment's been a lot slower than what LTE was designed to do because it's long-term evolution, so it's supposed to continuously evolve. Why do you think that's the case? Why do you think it's not evolving as fast as we've seen other technologies evolve, especially in the wireless case, and especially for a technology to evolve as fast as it normally does? We are seeing lots of evolution in various other places around us, especially in the IoT space.
You know, it's an interesting question. I think a lot of the pressure started being applied to use the LTE bands differently when some of the low power wide area network people came out. You've got your LoRa, Sigfox, there's a variety of them, and started putting some pressure on the carriers to come up with a solution. So I think maybe they were battling a little bit from their back foot, and thus the early fragmentation that occurred and still hasn't completely healed because they were, you know, in a counterpunch mode instead of what they're used to doing as far as dominating the market. So I think that's part of what caused it. You know, the other part is some of these new technologies, they have to deploy to all the base stations. They have to get things up and running, which they're trying to work on. But the, you know, ability to tie together the global roaming agreements and have, you know, things hand off to carriers operating different networks, it's, you know, that's the part that we're seeing some struggle with, is there's a lot of good chipset technologies out there now, but you can't really go to a carrier and get a global plan to use everyone's network in a consistent way for a consistent price. You know, so the business side doesn't exist for us yet. And then you've still got the issue where that technology has not been deployed to all the different geographies we need it. So, you know, we're in this kind of wait and see mode. And it's difficult because, boy, some of those technologies can do some amazing things, especially from a battery life point of view. I mean, battery, when it comes to mobile devices that are tracking and sensing, is you know, the crux of the matter for everyone and something you're always banging your head against the wall on. The new technologies are great for that, but it's going to be a while before they're consistent globally.
That's actually very true. I mean, that's what I've seen over and over again. So, you know, you started this amazing company. You've built some cool things. What are some of the lessons you'd pass on to other founders? What are some of the things you, especially from a hardware and IoT perspective, what are some things that you would say, you know, if I were to do this again, this is where I bonked my head and I'm glad I learned that lesson, but I don't want somebody else to bonk their head in that same spot.
You know, I think in the IoT space, the biggest thing for me is it's really customer readiness to use the solution you have. It's so easy to get involved in a trial or a pilot or some sort of experimentation with the customers. I mean, you know, I often think IoT should be industry of trials because that's what everyone in this space does. And it's so few and far between. You find a customer that really embraces the technology on a true enterprise-wide basis and makes it become part of their daily life. So my biggest advice would be, when you have a new solution, it's, in my experience, it's very rarely about can the technology do its job. It's about how do you make that technology work for your customer in the least disruptive manner possible. So,
I mean, kind of building on your point, right? This is one of the things I've seen over and over again is, and especially as of recent, we have seen the fact that technology can, we've gotten to the point where we can solve most, I would say good 90, somewhere in there, percent of the problems with technology. The technology's never been the problem or barrier anymore. It feels like now it's the business innovation that's actually the more often than not the barrier. Like you said, the trials. Is it worth it? Is it saving me enough to implement technology, or is it better just to leave the process that we have in place today? And then how much, like you said, how much of that barrier do I have to get over to retrain staff to implement this new process to get there that would necessarily let my business run, however that might be, without disruption, right? Like you said.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think you've really got to spend as much time innovating your product as you do learning your customers, because, you know, a big lesson we learned at OnAsset over the years, and we've suffered from this, is we've been victims of our own success. We deploy our product, it does exactly what it's supposed to do, but then the customer realizes it's highlighting all of the issues in their process. And the larger the customer, the less they really want to manage those problems, because 9 times out of 10, they don't use real-time information on a regular daily basis. So when they have this influx of visibility and they see all the dirty, dark corners of their business process, that naturally creates a pressure now to have to solve those problems. So we've seen in a lot of cases, let's just swipe that under the rug and kind of close this trial down and pretend this never happened, versus a true desire to mobilize and actually fix the issues. Because, you know, the larger the organization, the more complex, the more money that costs. So my biggest piece of advice would be, imagine your technology delivers 100% of the value you say it will. What does that actually mean for the customer? Because it will, in most cases, necessitate taking some action on their part. And you got to ask the customer up front, if I show you all the problems, do you want to fix them or do you want to forget about them? Because that's an early predictor of whether or not your trial will become something more Is your customer already thinking through the process of what are, you know, steps 3, 4, and 5 after you get the technology in place to effectively use it and make it part of your daily life?
Yeah, and you just brought up a good point, right? Because it's a large customer. So sometimes I've seen more often than not management buy-in, but then somewhere in the middle below the upper level management that, I mean, you may get executive buy-in, but ultimately you're going to have to try and convince the rest of the company to say, yeah, we're willing to change this. I'm willing to give up part of my fiefdom, because that also happens, especially a lot in larger corporations. I'm willing to give up part of my fiefdom to change to something better. And so how do you wrap your head around that challenge? If you get a customer that has some of that buy-in and they say, yeah, we want to do this, we'll invest into this, how do you get past that point?
You know, that's a particularly hard one, because that actually requires you to live and breathe your customer's business. You know, you've got to get in and engage. And like you said, get down to the level of the guy at the dock door, the guy that's, you know, packing that shipment and sending it out the door. How does it work at his level? How do you make his life easier? How does he incented to use your solution? Because it always amuses me, you know, there's so many platform analytics, AI companies that are coming out of the woodwork. Those make great management tools and dashboards, but if it doesn't make the feet on the street embrace the solution, the management guys can love the dashboards all day long, but if the warriors that have to implement at the ground level aren't excited about it, it will by definition become another trial, another science project, another experiment that management will like, but, you know, management can only push so hard. Ultimately, people have to embrace it at every level of the organization. And you need to think about how you make your solutions easy, because, you know, the guy at the dock door doesn't want to deal with a complex dashboard. He doesn't want to have to make, you know, 5 or 6 button clicks beyond his extra process to make these things work.
We had a slight technical difficulty. Of course we would on our last time at Nerdvana, but apparently we had power run out on us. So I know I interrupted you on your thoughts of where you've run out on, you know, or where to get buy-in for middle management and where you've run kind of your lessons learned from that. You know, is there, outside of getting the buy-in from the boots on the ground, which I think is absolutely accurate, what else have you learned? What other lessons have you learned as far as timelines, expectations with customers? And especially getting them to understand timeline expectations, especially now that they're moving towards hardware and not necessarily software that they're not necessarily used to.
So another big thing is kind of are they prepared operationally to use, you know, these kind of things. So we actually have a document we've glued together over the decade we've been in business. We call it the 4 Pillars of Implementation Success. And it is literally a list of a couple hundred questions. We can ask the customer just to quiz them how far they've thought through all of this, because again, it's super easy to get a trial or a demo. Everyone will say yes to that.
Right.
But if you start asking them questions.
Hang on. And this is another key question, especially on the startup side. I mean, you guys have lasted now beyond startup phase into something that's like a nice, solid company. I mean, once you pass 3 to 5 years, you're no longer a startup, really. I mean, you guys are still somewhat lean and small, but you guys have enough of a customer base, enough of a revenue base that you guys have survived and keep and continue to survive. But how do you get past the, let's give you a free trial to let's get you a paid trial and get their skin in the game so they're more incentivized to do as such?
The one thing we've learned is we don't do a free trial. It's either a paid engagement, because, you know, at the end of the day, they've, like you said, they've got to put some skin in the game, or the trial has to directly have measurable success criteria that lead to something afterwards. So we will go in and create, you know, a metric of the success criteria, but it's got to be something that you can measure. It can't be subjective. Well, did you, you know, like the color of XYZ? It's got to be very specific. Did the data do this? Did we deliver this? Did the system perform like this? Because, you know, the customers who will back away from that type of engagement are the ones that aren't serious. Anyone who will say, give me a, if it's not a free trial, I'm not interested, you know their entire kicking mode. And we'll typically say, you know, good luck. We know there's other people in the market that will give free trials. If you'd like, go call this, this, and this. After you're done with that and you have a better idea of what you want to do, give us a call back and then we can engage.
Yeah, and that goes back to your document you just referenced, right? So that when you put that document in front of them and say, look, you know, we understand your entire kicking mode. Here's some of the other things you do. How do you balance that and say, look, we've actually put together a fairly good success criteria that we've seen over and over again. Some customers would take, I guess, offense to that maybe. Have you seen that issue or has that not been a case?
It has happened a couple times where you have someone who, you know, almost seems like they're insulted because you want to dig into the details of their business and operations and have they thought through this or thought through that. We also find that the people who tend to take that approach are also not the ones that are going to go somewhere we want to go with them. We're polite about it, but we don't say yes to everything. And that was, believe me, it's not that I'm not a yes man. We used to say yes to everything. When we first started, no was not in our vocabulary. And that's what we've learned over time is sometimes you have to focus yourself. And if your customer doesn't demonstrate focus, sometimes you have to find a different customer because they will waste your time. They will let you give them as much of that free trial as you are willing to give them, and they will abuse you in the process. And not because they want to, but because they're in discovery mode as well. So, you know, you've got to get to a point where you can almost be a detective with your customer and sniff out what mode they're really in to decide how to handle them, because you don't want to necessarily say no to people who are in discovery mode.
Right.
But you don't want to treat them like you would someone who's a little bit more mature and more ready.
This is the first time in I think these episodes where I think we've covered the other side of it, where how do you get past all these kind of interesting issues? And it's really funny is, you know, we originally started this podcast just to talk about what are you people making and how did they go about making it? And it's evolved from that to, hey, you know, let's talk about IoT, because IoT is a big thing, as we both very well know. I mean, you're clearly entrenched in the asset tracking space and in general, just the IoT space, just because, again, one of my other favorite, you said 2006, one of my other favorite references over and over again, and I think this is our third podcast in a row, I'll say this, is Twister was an IoT movie. Twister, it was 1996, and they had little dot sensors flying into a cloud and capturing all this data and then, you know, logging it all and doing all sorts of other stuff. That's technically IoT. Technically, it's also big data and all sorts of other buzzwords that we have now. But that was over 22 years ago. And then 10 years from the genesis of what you were starting to do with DHL. And then, you know, it has kind of grown from there, but I don't think people have fully realized that it's not just building the little devices. I mean, you saw they quickly iterated in that movie. They were like, oh, we got to add little spinny top things. No, we got to add more weight. It's got to be sucked into the cloud in a certain way. It's got to do this. It's got to do that. But like you said, that's the easy part, right? The engineering part's the easy part. It's getting all of the rest of the business buy-in to actually move the science experiment forward and say, let's go somewhere with this. So through all those learning processes and being around for as long as you guys have and being on the cutting edge of everything, what's next for you guys? Where are you guys interested in going now? Like, what are you working on next? What's the exciting thing that's got you really excited after 10 years of asset tracking?
Well, you know, first of all, I'll never see the movie Twister the same way again.
But I ruin it for everybody.
Going back to that, where we're going is we're thinking about how do we instrument more of the things in the supply chain, not just the shipments, but the equipment, the infrastructure, all of that, in a way that these things can work together to kind of crowdsource what they need to get the job done. Because we've traditionally focused on a, you know, very full-featured, all-inclusive, autonomous device that can travel anywhere in the globe. But there's a cost to that. There's an expense that keeps you in a certain sector of the market. So we're trying to move, you know, down market with solutions that perhaps relay and rely on those types of devices, but are very low cost in and of themselves. So you can now instrument the infrastructure of logistics and make all of those things talk together, but do it in a way where you don't have to build all the functionality into those things. So much like, you know, the cheap sensors that fly into the tornado, we're trying to come up with a series of very cost-effective devices that can leverage each other to gather the edge information. Because, you know, it's interesting. I see the predominance of the IoT market focusing on, you know, the quote platform side of things. And I mean, I think we're all fatigued with the, you know, platforms that come left and right. You know, everybody's talking kind of AI, analytics, big data, blockchain, all of these things, but none of those systems can work effectively without the edge data, and so, data with quality.
That's the other interesting new movement that's happened. So, right, you just kind of hit every major buzzword we've been hearing for forever. And that's the fun part, right? The marketing side of the folks will say, okay, this is the buzzword. It's like right now, the big one that I hear every other day. And I think a couple of weeks ago I was at Collision, and you know, the buzzword of the day there was blockchain. And there's a ton of more blockchain startups, and I've been hearing blockchain over and over, and we're going to use it for this and that and smart contracts and provenance and blah 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 blah. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, now there's I can track my tomato. I just saw an article this morning on LinkedIn saying I could track my tomato from farm, from when the plant was grown, to the farm, to the farmer who picked it, to the truck that sent it over, like you said, supply chain logistics, to meeting it at the restaurant. Do I care that much? Maybe, because it might be the bad lettuce that might get me sick or whatever we've had those problems for right now. But the other thing that's been the other big buzzword that I keep on hearing is edge compute. Now everybody's sticking computing to the edge, which is kind of funny because we keep on going these like cyclical movements. At first, again, I love these old school references because people don't tend to look to history, and then I kind of tend to like make people go, oh crap, you ruined, like, you not ruined it necessarily, but I feel like Adam ruins everything, the other big cool better Adam than me. And then we've got you, Adam, and then yeah, it's a whole thing. But anyways, but the other thing that's really funny is, you know, 1980s, we had DOS terminals, we had dummy terminals, and then everything was done technically in the cloud, but it was called terminal computing or mainframe computing, whatever you want to call it, but it was technically the cloud. And then we went to, no, let's move everything to the edge, give faster compute to the user's hands, take load off the network, and just make the network that much more efficient. And then now we've started going back the other way around to terminal computing, right? So now we have everything running in virtual machines, and you just log in via a much lower powered device to manipulate the data, do whatever it is, but it's still in essentially a mainframe environment. It's in a cloud environment. And now we're going backwards again. We're starting to put everything back out towards the user's hands and saying, no, let the user compute it all. And then we'll do much more network optimization and efficiency. So where do you see that going? Because now we're going back in a circle again, it seems like.
Well, you know, there's a lot of things there that are particularly frustrating for me, because people come up with these buzzwords. And like you said, it's spinning a concept that frankly has been around for quite some time. But it seems revolutionary because you put a new word around it. So it's, you know, we go into a lot of executive meetings with large companies. Well, what are we doing about the blockchain? Well, you know, the blockchain concept in and of itself is not earth-shattering. It's, you know, what are you doing about wanting to share your information? And then they, well, we don't want to share information. It's like, well, then you don't want blockchain, because that's natively what it's supposed to be for, is so that everybody can see, you know, a data stream collectively and work better as a team. But it's, you know, they get wrapped around the buzzwords, and it's a constant problem. We walk into meetings, well, we need, you know, artificial intelligence. Okay, well, what do you think that means? Do you think you're going to load a bunch of data into a system and a computer's going to tell you how to run your business better? You know, you have to train these systems to be able to do things for you. So there's no magic button that says, IoT make my life better? And that's, I think, a misconception. And I think these buzzwords and all of these things don't help the situation, because it makes people think, uneducated people think, that somehow all of this is easy to do. You still have to put in the work. You still have to process the data. You still have to filter the data. You still have to take all of this and get to the heartbeat of what matters. And you know, the technology is there. It's been there. You could have tracked your tomato from farm to fork a decade ago, but businesses weren't ready to do it a decade ago. And that's back to the whole operational readiness piece of this, is that what the thing I like about these buzzwords and all of this is it's starting, I think, to turn the tide, where these organizations now have more respect for the fact that they need to think about how to operationally use these technologies. And that's a good dialogue to have with them. But it's fundamentally not any different than what we could do 10 years ago when we started. But if it helps people get in the mode of thinking about operationalizing it, that's a good thing.
So you mean there's no Staples easy button?
No. And, you know, I talk to so many CTOs and CIOs that think these are magical tools. But at the end of the day, it's just like my two boys, right? They can do so many amazing things, but you have to educate them in order to get them pointed in the right direction. And all of these IoT tools, you still have to fundamentally educate on how your business operates, what's important to it, where you'd like to improve it, and then the tools can make some impact. But there's no big magic button where you feed your big data into this database and the, you know, computer screen pops out the equation to make your business better.
Right. I mean, you hit the nail on the head right there. I mean, I think that's a great example. You got two boys, and just like universally, everybody plays with Legos. You tell me somebody doesn't, right? We can give you all of the Legos in the world, like all the cool pieces, the big 4x4 bricks, the skinny like pieces and everything else. But is it the brick you need, and why do you need that brick? Is that the one that's the best for the situation you're in right now? I mean, it's the coolest new color, it's out of the new kit, but is that the right Lego brick?
Exactly. So, you know, we're on the same page there, and Legos is a popular tool around our house, especially with the new power functions and the boost kits and everything. I probably get 10 hours of Legos a week nowadays.
That's kind of awesome. That's actually exciting. I know the rest of our viewers are like, wait, Legos? What? We want to, or not viewers, listeners. I'm so used to, we're going to get the live stream eventually, I'm sure. You know, where can people find you? On LinkedIn, social media? What's your preferred kind of way to people find you? Where do they find more things about both?
So I'm on LinkedIn, on asset.com. You can learn about us there, and certainly contact your dear podcast host, and he can get you in touch with me as well.
I'll be more than happy to. Thank you so much for coming out, and this has been a great chat, and I know people have learned a lot more, especially on the supply chain side. That's something that we talk about asset tracking, but we rarely ever get this in depth to say, hey, let's peel away the onion layers and actually, you know, talk about this. So,
well, thanks for having me. This is fun stuff.